right, welcome to our Friday morning out from the Cube. We have a guest with us, St. Louisan. And again, it's one of these things that I'm meeting a ton of people with this podcast, and actually most of them, the past two or three that I've had with the podcast as Friday guests, I've never met. My first conversations with them were when we started talking online prior to the podcast. It was like a 5 or 10 minute prep of just introducing ourselves and all that sort of stuff. This episode, though, actually Tony and I actually went out and had a cup of coffee, but prior to that, we didn't know each other. And it was definitely a LinkedIn connection. I think actually, Tony, you may have reached out to me maybe because of the podcast, and you were interested
at that point.
I think you were interested in maybe just learning about the podcast, how to set up a podcast and all that. So, but before we get going, if you hear clicking in the background, it's because I have my notifications turned on. I don't know if you can hear that. But that's how it goes. But listen, I appreciate you making time for us. I think this was, we met maybe 6 weeks ago, and we just didn't have time. Our schedules didn't kind of coordinate, and I was with a client and things along that. But to start the podcast, we'll go about an hour or so like we typically do. But before we get to, you know, what you're doing and what you're involved with and the passions that you have and how you're impacting the St. Louis community and the community around you, I am interested in your take on the Super Bowl from this past week. This was released on Friday. We're actually recording this the Monday after the Super Bowl. And I know that you have a passionate background in football and do – now, let me – before you answer that, remind me, are our children the same age? I have an 8 and a 10-year-old. And isn't your kid somewhere around that age or maybe a little bit older?
A little bit older, yeah. I have four kids, 23, 15. I have twins that are 14. And my two youngest boys play football.
And how old are they?
15 and 14.
Oh, 15 and 14. So your kids are, 5 or 6 years older than mine. Okay. Yeah. And I remember the last time we talked, you were prepping for a big tournament or playoff thing with your kids. I think that weekend. And how did the football season end for you and your kids?
It did not end as we had anticipated, probably much like the Rams game last night. We did not come out on top as we'd hoped, but, there's always next season. So we had a great season all around and some really good kids.
That's great. You're a St. Louisan, right? Born and raised or?
Right. Born and raised, yes, sir.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because I brought this up last night with the group of people I was in and with and didn't get a great answer. The two teams that were in the Super Bowl, there are the New England Patriots, who if you are from St. Louis, that might be like 1A – the team you hate, because if you follow football, people say that the Patriots cheated the Rams out of a Super Bowl in the early 2000s. So, and I'm not a native St. Louisan, but I know people hate the Patriots in this area. And then on the other side, you have the LA Rams playing, which is the St. Louis Rams that moved maybe 3 years ago. And people were really upset about that around here. So you have these two teams that I think St. Louisans hate. So as a native St. Louisan, who did you watch the game? And because I heard people weren't. And if you did watch it, who were you rooting for? Or were you just rooting for a good game?
So we did watch the game. Full disclosure, my wife is a massive Patriots fan, has been since late 90s or early 2000s. And that stems from when we lived at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, kind of smack dab in the middle of the state. The Patriots were always who was on TV at that point. So from a who I was rooting for standpoint, I think I'm probably like the majority of St. Louisans. I genuinely hate the Stan Kroenke era. I feel like as a city, we got major leagued. If you remember the movie, Major League Baseball, where she tanked Brown, the Indians, all right. Cleveland Indians, they were gonna trade. I feel like that happened to us. And so I have just this insane hatred towards the organization and in particular Stan Kroenke, right? I think a lot of folks in St. Louis do. I'm not a big Patriots fan, but I found myself last night rooting for the Patriots because I don't want to see that man win a ring, right? And then I think most importantly from that, as a football fan, and when I say fan, I watch, 5-year-olds play flag football all the way up to high school, college, professional. I love the sport of football. And it makes me really sad to think that my kids never will have the opportunity to drive 15 to 20 minutes to downtown St. Louis and watch a football game. We are getting XFL, so I'm interested to see what that product looks like when they put that together here in St. Louis. But for the time being, I have converted to the Jaguars, which is my new team that I've been rooting for. I've had the Jaguars. Chance to see them a couple times.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. What was your take on the game?
It was definitely. I was expecting a lot more scoring. I did not expect 13-3. I think from a coaching standpoint, Bill Belichick proved why he is the best NFL quarterback or NFL coach of all time. I mean, he shut down the highest scoring team to include, if you look at St. Louis history, the greatest show in turf, this team put up more points than they did. To shut them down and only give up 3 points is insane. And to lose his best defender in the first half to a broken arm and continue to, you know, pull out and do it. I mean, it was a really well-coached game, and I just think the Rams were outclassed and outcoached for sure.
Yeah, actually, there's a ton of insight and leadership and coaching and motivation things that we could probably just talk about relative to that game and Bill Belichick and how he kind of runs his program. What has built up your passion in football? Why are you so passionate about it? Is it something you grew up playing? You played in college, like your passion for that game? Where's it come from?
Yeah. I mean, I played when I was a kid and I played through high school. I played till my sophomore year. I had a life experience where I my now wife and I had a child my junior year. So that changed the dynamics of my high school career and changed my football trajectory. I think the leadership and coaching aspect really stems down from my military service. I enjoy coaching. I like having that impact on, you know, individuals for that. And so football and coaching allows me to, you know, outside of my own 4 children, have an impact in a positive way, I think, for young men, to help them be better, be a positive male role model in their lives, and hopefully, you know, have an impact, you know, post just, you know, football. And I think that's really one of the reasons why I enjoy coaching football so much.
Yeah, that's what people, I think, you know, there are people that listen to this podcast, and we run the whole spectrum, I think, to a certain extent, where we get these, I know we get coaches. I know we get football coaches and basketball and college coaches. I know we do. And then we get these IT people. Like, we had a CEO on last week where we were talking about how I had cut the cable cord and I only have 2 channels now. And one is ESPN and the other is the Food Network. And he said, I have no use for either one of those channels, right? So you get those people that don't have anything to do with sports. But the thing that's kind of always, and I think it's on your mind and heart to a certain extent too, is the life lessons, the leadership lessons, the life skills that we can all learn, but definitely our children and youth through sports. You know, it's one thing if you have your kids involved in sports where they're just learning about football or basketball or whatever it might be, but where you find that real dynamic coach that lights, and actually Jason Wells, who's with us on Wednesdays, uses the phrase ignite, where a coach can just ignite a young, you know, boy or girl into a sport where it changes their life. And it's not even about basketball or football, but, you know, they just understand what hard work is and what sacrifice is and communication and teamwork and shared suffering and, you know, and how to collaborate and how to problem solve and how to do it quickly and how to make decisions, all that sort of stuff that I feel sports teach. There's one thing, and as you were kind of talking, I want to get into what you're doing and actually where you're at. Let's start there, actually. I want to, people that don't know the St. Louis community very well, you know, there's this great entrepreneurial spirit, I believe, in St. Louis. And you actually worked at a place or in a building where that might be the epicenter of it, right? I think there's one or two places in St. Louis that if you are kind of in that mode of being an entrepreneur and building different businesses, the place to go. And you work in a building called T-Rex, which is right downtown on Washington Street, I believe. And just, just tell us about that building, because it is, I'm not suggesting that it's unique, but it is the epicenter of St. Louis, because I'm sure other communities, other cities across this country have places like that. But what's T-Rex all about, and how did you end up there?
Yeah, I mean, so co-working has become pretty popular, right? There's for-profits like WeWorks that have, you know, built this entire multi-million dollar organization around, you know, creating cool collective spaces. I think from a T-Rex perspective, it's a organic family oriented. I mean, and that sounds like an odd way to describe a building, but, you know, we have the pleasure of sitting with 200 other companies that sit in this building, all from a lens of technology startups primarily. Mm-hmm. They have a high concentration of technology companies, cybersecurity, geospatial, open source technology. And, you know, for us, we're, you know, we're happen to be a nonprofit and probably different than some of those, but they consider us a support service, support organization for a lot of those companies. T-Rex, I can come here if I have an idea, and that idea, I want to be able to just flush it out. So I can go see Veteran Business Resource Center, Small Business Development Council, SBDC. They're going to help me with my business plan, help me shape that and really take that first step. As I'm doing those steps, I have the ability to, you know, get office hours with companies that are doing legal support and accounting. And, you know, when I have contracts, most type of questions, I have people to turn to. And then from even that, once I get some traction and some sales, I can go to, you know, some venture capital funds. All sits within this one space. So I can go from start to finish. And the goal is to eventually work yourself out of T-Rex, where it's not as cost effective to be able to do it. And you have to expand because your business is doing so well. I think what makes it unique is that family aspect, right? When, you know, there's a software company called Balto. They're up on the 7th floor. You know, they just received several million dollars from, you know, from some investors. And I feel like I share their successes. I mean, we kind of pass in the hallways and we get a few seconds to catch up here and there. But it's been really, really neat to see the success of others. And I think from a regionally kind of focused perspective, it brings really good light to our community and what potential there is for us to excel and grow.
Yeah. So I guess my next question would be, how did you end up there? But prior to answering that would be, well, I mean, what do you do and why did you find the need to be down at T-Rex with what you're doing or what you have done or what you started?
Yeah. So the Midwest Cyber Center, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we are a nonprofit. We focus on two things and I think we're doing pretty well. So how do we infuse, you know, talent into the workforce or, as we reference, educate the workforce of today? And then long-term is how do we, you know, engage middle school and high school students into see cybersecurity as a career field? So, you know, we have an apprenticeship program. We engage the students in camps, clubs, and competitions. So over the course of about the last 3 years, we've, you know, impacted and come across about 2,000, 3,000 people. Mm. You know, just, you know, kind of evangelizing this idea of cybersecurity and what opportunities are out there. From how we got the T-Rex perspective, our start as an organization actually came from, it was kind of born out of a community idea, but really started with the Scattered Force Base community. They, like many government agencies are really having a hard time, you know, finding talent to fill roles. The government, because of security clearances and lots of other aspects, you know, it's hard to find those folks. There's a ridiculously long wait list for security clearances at this moment. So how could they find folks that they could fit into those roles? So we've, you know, that came together, the Regional Chamber and Leadership Council of Southwest Illinois. They all came together as a group, said, hey, we need to do something collective. We need that one kind of consistent voice around that. And that's where Midwest Cyber Center came into play. From how we get to T-Rex perspective, you know, and you alluded to a little bit earlier, but it seems to be the epicenter, right? There are other spaces like Cortex, which is amazing. It's that corridor between WashU and SLU and BJC Hospital, when they're creating this work, live, play, learn environment, which is great. But from a, you know, central location for us, downtown is great. You know, I love the city, you know, tremendously. So, you know, us sitting here in T-Rex, we have access to lots of space. So it's central for if I'm in Illinois, it's central if I'm, you know, west of here in St. Charles County or Chesterfield. So it provides, you know, just a good common space for folks to come and experience the environment that is T-Rex.
So the foundation and base of your company, your nonprofit, is cybersecurity and building up the workforce and educating people on the needs and opportunities available to them in cybersecurity.
Correct. Sure. We have, I think it's predicted to be 1.5 million roles between now and 2021 that are available that are going to go unfilled because just, you know, the supply of professionals and the demand are not equal right now. So, you know, we believe it's going to take a combination of traditional pathways like 2 and 4 year colleges, universities to non-traditional programs like our apprenticeship program to fill that gap. That's really where we started. And, you know, long-term, you know, even for the middle school, high school perspective, if we're getting in front of kids earlier, you know, there are kids in the world that are going to have opportunities to go to college, and there's kids that are not going to have those opportunities. So, you know, whether they go to, you know, university or community college, or they find a program like ours, we're making a dent into that space either way.
So is it, how many people do you work with on a daily basis? Is it just you? I mean, tell me about your kind of your own workforce for your company.
Yeah. So we are a massive team of 3.5. So I have myself, I have a program director, and I have a program coordinator that we just kicked off last week, thanks to some support from the state of Missouri, a pre-apprenticeship program, which allowed us to hire a part-time adjunct instructor. So we're fortunate for that. We are going to add a fourth here really soon. We have a need, I think, really for that. I'm saying words that are weird to me in the nonprofit space I'm just unaccustomed to, but we need, you know, a business development person that's out advocating to employers and educating them on the importance of hiring apprentices. That's, from a revenue perspective, is a big part of our success is getting our apprentices placed. So finding that person who's out hitting the streets 40 hours a week to do some company outreach. So we'll add that and we'll backfill a position here in the next couple months. So we'll be, by the end of the year, 5.5 folks.
At 5.5, perfect, right? So T-Rex is the optimal place for you to network and to meet people and to try to take that to the next level and you build it up. You know, one of the things is when we talked, like your story, your journey to where you're at was really riveting to me. And there were like, and I'm always looking for kind of these small takeaways. And I didn't ask this offline, right? But the things we talked about over a cup of coffee and kind of your life's journey, we're open to talk about that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, perfect. Because I didn't ask you offline, so I apologize for that and not put you on the spot. But there was, but you mentioned it briefly when we started going, because I think when I walked away from our coffee, having a cup of coffee together, I kind of, when I got in the car and drove away, I was thinking about how things, when you were 17, 16, to, you know, this 30-year-old mark, kind of that mark, how I felt things maybe had been stacked against you. Maybe things didn't go according to your plan. And then I see you, you know, how you've crushed it and how you have this great life and this great attitude and this great, and, you know, and the kid and your children and your involvement and you and your wife and all this sort of stuff. I was like, I was just really inspired by it. I really was. I was like, man, there's a guy that just had things maybe stacked against him and didn't really care and is still just knocking things out and making a difference, making an impact with your personal community, but also the community of St. Louis. So maybe to circle back, you said this 10 minutes ago or so, that when you were 16, 17, somewhere in there, junior year of high school, that you and your girlfriend at the time, she got pregnant, right? And you ended up having a son around that, a son or a daughter around that age. What was that? How hard is that to begin with? You know, to be, you know, to have something like that happen at that age when you have maybe all these dreams, plans, and ambitions, and I'm sure you were involved in sports and athletics and all this sort of stuff, and now you're like, whoa, wait a minute here.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you know, changed things. You know, my wife now and my girlfriend at the time, who is my wife, you know, we'd been dating for a couple of years, and You know, one thing led to another. I think we've all heard the story of the birds and the bees.
Right.
And we made a few bad decisions, and then, you know, we're shocked and to find out she was pregnant. And I think, like most, we had some denial on that aspect for a little while, and eventually had to fess up to our parents that, hey, you know, this is a thing, and, you know, we're going to have to deal with it. And so, you know, my parents and her parents, the story I remember vividly, right? So I think my mom had believed that I was a virgin until the time I told her that, you know, my girlfriend was pregnant. So the story is vivid in my mind, because we were sitting after work and school, and she'd come into the kitchen, and I sat up on the counter and shared with her, hey, you know, Katie's pregnant. And there were some tears and some shock. And, you know, I think, like, you know, most parents would in that situation, they said, oh, all right, this is what's going to happen. And so my mom was very adamant about a few things, right? You're going to take responsibility, and you're going to do, you know, you're going to provide for your kid, and you're going to, you know, get insurance for your son, and do all the stuff, you know, all the right things that you should do, and own it. So I went from, you know, playing football and hanging with friends to, you know, working 30 to 40 hours a week, going to school full time, and just committed to doing it. And I guess, you know, hindsight, and you're very complimentary to me. And I, you know, I think my, you know, maybe my Army days and my core values really resonate with me. I'm humbled, and I guess I never think through, you know, some of the things that you'd mentioned, the adversity that we have come through over the years to be where we're at. I think we beat odds more than a few times on, you know, us continuing to stay married and successful. And, you know, my wife and I have shared a lot of successes in that, and I feel blessed, right, to do that. So, you know, hit high school, he was born, I was 17. I mean, when we got pregnant, I was 16, she was 15. We were 17 and 16 when we had him. Very fortunate to have parents that were supportive, right? I mean, they didn't celebrate the teen pregnancy. I think, I don't know how you can, it wasn't the norm, but they, you know, made sure that we were, available and ready to, you know, finish high school and do the things that we needed to do, you know, and check things off the list so we would be set up for success long term. So, I mean, I remember pictures of my wife coming home from the hospital and the day after, you know, holding our son, doing homework so she didn't fall behind in school, right? That was a very, you know, important thing for both of us. So, you know, I, like most high schoolers, had, you know, aspirations to go on and do things. And I really wanted to be a pediatrician. You know, hindsight, I was like, man, I want to be a pediatrician. I, you know, worked hard, had good grades in school, got accepted into SLU, St. Louis University, in a pre-med program, and quite honestly, was not mentally prepared. I was, you know, fortunate. I am an only child, so I was fortunate to never want for anything. And my parents gave me a lot. And if you ask some of my friends, probably too much over the years, you know, had a lot of opportunity, and I just took it for granted. And, you know, did not do well at St. Louis University. And three semesters later, they said, hey, you've got to get out of here. Your grades are bad. We like your money, but we're not going to keep taking it from you. So they put me, stepped out of school, went from St. Louis University to St. Charles Community College. And it was much the same. I wasn't mentally prepared for college or the rigor that it was. So I wound up, you know, kind of taking a step back, worked full time at a lumber yard in St. Charles County, and, you know, worked 40 hours a week, and, you know, did my thing, and found myself surrounded with not great people that were doing things that I probably shouldn't have been doing. And I was like, man, I just had a moment, an epiphany. It's like, I have to do something to change my life here. And like a lot of folks, I called her a military recruiter, right? Sergeant Nicholas Ornelas. You know, I remember that guy today, and, you know, we had had conversations, and, you know, much like the telling my mom that we were having a child, I told her the same thing about the military, and some tears and some worries there. And, you know, in 1998, in May, I joined the Army, and the rest, as they say, is history, right? I served 9 years active duty, was military police, you know, like a lot of the military's, and this is going to totally downgrade with military service, but the military service isn't hard, right? Like you show up, you do the right thing, you much like a Bill Belichick environment, right? You're part of a team, you fill in, you do your job, and the rest kind of comes easy. And I spent my first 2 years in Germany and had a blast, maybe some regrets. I wish I would have traveled a lot more and seen the beautiful country of Europe that I didn't, but I was 19 and could drink legally. So I, you know, spent a lot of time in nightclubs and doing other stuff. And then moved back to Missouri at Fort Leonard Wood. And my wife and I got married at that point. I think we were 22 and 21 and our son was 4 or 5 at that moment. And then I made sergeant and then it just clicked, right? That idea of service and putting others before myself really started to resonate. I saw the impact that a first line manager sergeant would have on, you know, young people's lives and have impact. And, you know, was taken back to those that I served with in Germany that really took an interest in my career, right? At the time when I was 18, I hated them. Jason Klinger, if he happens to listen to this, hopefully he does at some point. But so, you know, we were all single guys in Germany, and Jason Klinger was married with a couple kids, and every holiday he would always invite us over, right? Nobody wanted to go, right? Nobody wanted to go because they didn't want to hang out with their boss on a holiday. And but his wife would always cook us this amazing dinner and would welcome us in as their family. And at the moment, and he would ask us to do correspondence courses and take college and all these things that nobody wanted to do. But taking a step back a few years later, man, like he was a great leader that, you know, I still continue to quote clearly, you know, just from the impact that he had on my life over the years.
Right.
So, stayed at Fort Leonard for 7 years. Went from sergeant to staff sergeant and eventually, you know, kind of worked my way to become a drill sergeant, which I had a blast with. Best job in the military. Get paid extra money to yell at kids and have a good time with it. But, you know, more importantly than yelling, you know, you're taking 18-year-olds and that are, you know, fresh from high school that have no concept of laundry, you know, how to shave and things that, you know, we kind of take for granted of like simple life things, but it's amazing that there are kids at 18 have no idea how to do that. So, you know, over the course of, you know, 17 weeks, 18 weeks of boot camp and school, you turn that 18-year-old into a soldier that at that point, Iraq and Afghanistan were pretty hot and heavy. So these young men and women were leaving basic training and in theater 30 days later. So, you know, put a little extra emphasis on, you know, how we were treating soldiers because, you know, we were at a, you know, high point of conflict and war. And, you know, that still today continues for my leadership aspect.
Wow. I mean, there's a lot that we could get into there. This is a sidebar to this. I probably will have to edit this part out. This meeting's going to end in 6 minutes. I will edit this out. So the meeting's going to end in 6 minutes. I'm going to have to spin up another one. This has never happened before. So I'll have to spin up another one to finish this. Okay. I'll take that part out. So we got 5 minutes and I just want, there's a lot to unpack there. I think, I guess there's one thing I want to say, and we don't have to continue to go down this road. The one thing out of the box that I really admire you on, and again, we've had a cup of coffee and don't know each other that well, and we've just kind of shared some stories. Without question, the one thing I admire you is that you had a girlfriend at, you know, 15, 16 years old, had a child with her, and I'm guessing you're close to my age or a little under my age. I'm 45. I think, I forget what, how old are you? I forgot what you said.
40.
So you're close to my age, but younger than me. And that you're still with her. I really admire that. I really admire that. Now, maybe it's the support group you had and the families and making right decisions and all that. And I'm not suggesting things haven't been hard or rough or whatever it is. I just really admire that.
My wife is the same, man. You know, even moving back to St. Louis and I think of that conversation, we were, you know, we spent 9 years at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri and loved it, right? We were kind of ingrained into the community. She had friends and she had a good job that was there. And, you know, I said, I really kind of want to move back to the St. Louis region. I think there's a lot of opportunity there for us. And, you know, we kind of had a gentleman's agreement that if we found something, we would move. And if we didn't, we'd stay. And, you know, I had interviewed for a nonprofit job and, you know, happened to be at the moment, I wasn't sure what that was. But, you know, she followed me and agreed to bring our four kids back to St. Louis for not very much money, might I add, within the space, you know. So we doubled our cost of living and, you know, cut our income in half on a hope and a prayer, and the rest kind of worked out. So I've been fortunate that she has supported me in a lot of these things and been by my side for nonprofits, and I've dragged her to galas and fundraisers and trivias. Right. And continues to smile with it. And, you know, she has her own success within her own career and has continued to have great work ethic. And I think for our oldest son, who's 23 now, you know, that is that for him, he has an insane work ethic in 23 and is, I think, the youngest manager of the Sprint store. You know, I think he's learning some life lessons in that and trying to figure out his niche and space, what he wants to do. But I hope that between my wife and I, they see that commitment to hard work and, you know, that never give up attitude and just kind of push them forward. So that's one thing I hope my kids take from both of us. It's really that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a great story here that's really inspiring to me. Okay. For those that are listening, we actually ran into some mild technical issues. So we're actually splicing together two parts to this episode. First 28 or so minutes. We definitely got into Tony's background in the service and, some things that happened in high school with having a child, you know, while he was still in high school and things of that nature. The one thing you said in part one of our discussion, and I wrote this down early this morning. You said that you became a drill sergeant, and that struck me a little bit. I don't know you terribly well. You do seem very calm and chill and relaxed and, you know, process, you know, like taking things in, where I picture this drill sergeant being this, you know, full metal jacket guy. But you said something that really kind of struck me. That you either enjoyed, I don't know exactly how you phrased it, that you enjoyed or you liked yelling at 18-year-old kids, something kind of tongue-in-cheek. But you said that you enjoyed turning 18-year-olds into soldiers. And for whatever reason, that just hit me this morning. You know, I was listening to our episode, part one, early this morning. And I guess I'm wondering about, you know, one, I'm fascinated by the service and admire the service and respect everybody that has served because, one, I don't have that toughness gene in order to do that. What's it take to turn an 18-year-old into a soldier?
Well, I mean, I think the philosophy of the military is to break people down and then build them back up, right? And that's from, if you look at the 9 weeks of basic training, and it's broken down into three sequences. So the very first phase is red phase, and that's that initial get them in, scream profusely, yell. Of course, you can't say bad words anymore, and there's lots of things in a kinder, gentler army you can't do what you did back in the 70s. But the idea is to kind of break everybody down, put them onto an even playing field. So regardless of socioeconomic background, race, gender, right, they're all on a level playing field and starting from zero. And then from that point, you're instilling the values, you know, the structure, the rules that accompany the military, because at some point that person will be dependent on somebody else, whether it's in battle, in the daily work environment. So you're trying to build that teamwork and camaraderie. The second phase is, it's been a long time. Was it white? I believe it's white. And then that's more around BRM, where they're basic rifle marksmanship and they're shooting guns and,
So is the intensity of this white phase substantially less? Is it still yelling and screaming up at 4 or 5 in the morning and running 5, 6, 7 miles and doing additional training, you know, like marksmanship and things you're saying? Is it as intense?
Yeah, the intensity is still there. I don't – in red phase, you're controlling every aspect of their life. So from wake up – where you're banging, you know, trash cans and throwing stuff out and, you know, waking them up in a, what's the right word I'm looking for? Waking them up in a hurry and they have 10 or 15 minutes and you're yelling at them the whole time to get dressed and into formation and do PT and into the chow hall. So that red phase, I mean, you're controlling every minute, every second of their day. to make sure they're getting to where they need to be. And then eventually, over the course of the couple, 2 or 3 weeks, they learn that routine, and then they jump into the basic rifle marksmanship. And from there, similar philosophy, right? Just still waking them up early. You're still doing the same thing. It's just, there's a little less intense. You're now giving live rounds to 18-year-old kids that are shooting guns. So, you have to be mindful of those type of things. There's a lot more movement and interaction that's there. So it's less basic stuff, more rifle marksmanship. Right. But they're working, they're doing stuff from 4:30 in the morning all the way up until, 9 o'clock at night.
Wow. And that was, is there a third phase to that?
There is. So it's a tail end, and then it's more the combat centric, right? So they're learning tactics and procedures of how to shoot, move, and communicate. So they're taking the basic skills, the marching, the rifle marksmanship, and then applying that into a combat type of environment. So, that's where your final foot march is, where you're doing, I don't remember the distance, 12 or 15 mile foot march. You're going out into the field and sleep in the woods and in tents and,
wow,
not a Coleman tent that sleeps eight. It's you have a half of a shell and your battle buddy has the other half of the shell, and it's the size of, it's probably 3 or 4 foot wide that you're sleeping next to somebody. So it's not a fancy tent. And, so you're doing that for the first, the final of that. And then they become soldiers from that component and eventually transition to their technical school where they learn their career.
Okay. Now, is a drill sergeant involved, kind of soup to nuts with all three phases? Like, were you with one group all the way through, or would you specialize as a drill sergeant in certain things?
So as military police, we have OSET, one station unit training. So we kept our particular troops for 17 weeks. So for that, so you're with that group that entire time. So okay, there are times that you're spending more time with them than you are your own spouse and kids, right? I mean, you're with them more times out of the day. So you do build a relationship and a level of trust and respect or hate for some of them, right? That you don't want to interact with, but they're with you the entire time.
Right. How has it been having, I think you said you have 3 children, right? Is that right?
I have 4 children.
Four children. Let me ask it this way. I'm guessing that you believe the tactics and strategies to build men work. Like, you were a drill sergeant, 17 weeks. When they come out on the other end, that they're men, soldiers, all that sort of stuff, and able to contribute and take care of each other, take care of our country. I would have to believe that you believe in those tactics. Is that fair?
Yeah, my military is fantastic, for sure.
How hard was it for you then, as a parent, to raise your children and not have it be just like the military? That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, man, this works. This is what I'm used to. I'm a drill sergeant for X amount of time, and it's clearly working, and I'm a builder of men. And they're coming out able to contribute to our service, but also able to contribute to their to their lives, all this sort of stuff, right? I'm going to do the same thing with my kids. When my kids get a certain age, it's going to be is it hard to do that as a parent that comes from such a strong military background, especially from somebody that was a drill sergeant?
Yeah, I mean, it's I would say my oldest probably had a different experience. I mean, I've mellowed out over the years from my old, my oldest. I probably had, I was a little more demanding on him. I was quicker to temper than I am now. And I think my kids and I were talking this past week and around, I can't think of the last time I lost my cool and got really angry about things, but my kids are older, they're a little more independent. So I think it's just that naturally evolves from that, and as opposed to little kids. But I think, some of the things, that you're teaching in the military aspect around cleanliness, attention to detail, being on time, those are things that, I try to instill in my kids. Doesn't always necessarily work. I think they're probably at a disadvantage to some extent, where I can walk into a room and see things that they probably wouldn't think I see, like, dirty dishes, and I'll walk out and 2 days later realize, hey, that same dish is still sitting there. Like, what's up with that?
Right.
So there's some of those things I think just come from that.
Do you kind of buy into the adage of how you do one thing is how you do all things? I would see that in the military. Like, hey, you know, the attention to detail, the making your bed and having things be tight and your foot lock, like, and again, I have no experience with this. This is all Hollywood movie stuff, right? But it's my perspective on what I think goes on. But it's kind of those things like, hey, if you're not going to pay attention to those details, how can I count on you for these larger items? Is that fair to you? Is that a military thing? Is that something you believe?
Yeah. I mean, I'll put that as personal appearance, right? I mean, to this day, I still make my bed every day when I get up. I still iron and starch my dress shirts every day when I go. So, I mean, it's things that I look back and you know, soldiers and those in the military today will never have the pleasure of spit shiny boots because everything is now desert, you know, and they're tan and they're not leather. I have hours upon hours of my life spent in shiny boots to make sure I looked good. And part of that was, you know, if you take enough pride in how you present yourself and, you know, as an outward appearance that generally shows some level of confidence that others are going to resonate and see, hey, man, that guy looks great. They've got their stuff together. I'm going to, you know, put some trust and faith in that. So if you take that into a job interview or civilian market, you know, people naturally gravitate those that look like they have their stuff together and, you know, are packaged well. And, you know, and there's some of that first impression. So, I mean, I still, a lot of that still resonates with me, and I, you know, it's 11 years later, still do a lot of the things I did when I was in the military. I don't think about it. It's just now it's just normal. Yeah. But, you know, I definitely would attribute that to those days.
You said something. So again, people listening, we recorded part one of this a couple of weeks ago. We did record a part two of this. It just did not work. So we actually talked for maybe 45 minutes after, and it just didn't record, which is always fun to recall a guest and say, hey, we're going to do this again. But you said something, and I have it in my notes. I can't find the page in my notes. And you were able to rattle these values, these military army values off quickly. And I wrote them down, and you know what I'm talking about, these values. There's five or six of them. Could you tell them to us again? And I'm going to make sure to write these down so I have them exactly where I want them this time.
Yeah. So loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and personal courage. So it's an acronym. It's leadership is the acronym.
And what was it? What was the S again?
Selfless service.
Selfless service. Now, this is what I like, and I spoke about this in a podcast after you and I had talked. Loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and what was the last one?
Personal courage.
Personal courage. And one thing, I talked about this after you and I had recorded, and I was looking at my notes and brought this up, and what I really liked about it was, you know, I don't know how many years you've now been removed from the Army or being a drill sergeant or instilling those values in having those values instilled in you and you instilling them in other people in the service. But your ability to rattle those off after all these years, it was just impressive to me. And it was impressive to me because, man, if you had to tell me what I stood on and how the decisions I make, how I lead teams and the type of employee I am or the type of, you know, spouse or father, whatever it might be, man, I couldn't come up with that stuff. I'm willing to bet that is how you run your life on those values of loyalty and duty and responsibility of service, honor, integrity, and courage, that those, you know, six or so items, that's how you run your life to this day. Is that a fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Resonate more than others, right? I would say loyalty is probably a big one for me on many fronts, right? I'm always going to do what's right for others and vice versa. And integrity is also really important to me. I'm always myself. I'm always authentic. And, you know, and I take a lot of pride in that. And sometimes, you know, it might comes off the wrong way. I'm a little, I can be an a-hole from time to time and, you know, and not always, you know, deliver my message that, but I'm always honest and, you know, upfront as best I can.
And so I want to make sure that we get into, you know, what you're doing now and, yeah. You know, but I'm really interested in what you're doing now, how these values lock in with how you run your company, your clients, your prospects, all that sort of stuff. And I know the answer. I mean, you kind of just gave it. I mean, this is the foundation of your business, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's the foundation of my life. You know, if you would have, when I transitioned from the military, you know, that's a hard thing, right? I mean, I think there are people getting out of the service every single day and trying to find that next step, right? And I think a lot of the individuals that transition from the military wind up getting stuck in this, hey, I want to find a job, right? And it's because they want to pay bills and they've got families and things they need to provide for. But a lot of times it foregoes that idea of a career, right? And pursuing things that you're really passionate about that get you excited to wake up in the morning. So I've been, you know, fortunate to land into this nonprofit space.
Right.
Fortunate to, you know, have the last, you know, nearly 10 years of my life committed to helping others in one way or another, whether, you know, through fundraising or program or volunteer recruitment. You know, all those roles have had the ability to have an impact in somebody else's life. And I really like that calling. I think the one thing that when I look at, you know, the missing piece of what I'd really like to do is that teaching aspect, right? I do miss that aspect from the military and that idea of the drill sergeant. Yes, yelling at them is one thing, but that idea of coaching and mentoring and that idea of expert knowledge, right? I think, right. You know, I always tried to, when I picked classes that I taught as drill sergeant, we would, you know, we'd go through and pick different things. I would generally try to gravitate those that I felt most comfortable about, because it's easier to, you know, to speak and present on things that you have an expert level of knowledge about. So, you know, that an adjunct professor teaching in college, or, you know, I debated going back and being a teacher in a school, you know, high school. Mm-hmm. That's the one piece that I really like to find a way to, or an avenue to get into it. And I probably could, I just haven't pursued it per se.
So, well, what exactly is the nonprofit that you're involved with? What do you do on a daily basis with this? And I really like, I mean, I'm taking a lot more notes, and it's hard for me to take notes when I'm trying to also facilitate the conversation a bit, but I really like the phrase expert knowledge. Let me ask this question real quick, because I have an opinion on this and my opinion is wrong, and you will give me your opinion and I will roll with that forever. What does duty mean?
Oh, duty. I mean, I think it's just, you know, it's getting up and doing the right thing. We're all charged in our lives to do something, and it's our responsibility to fulfill that duty. You know, for me, it's, you know, to take it to where we're at the Midwest Cyber Center. My duty is to help people start careers in cybersecurity. You know, and it's an important part of this job. And we win, every, you know, employers win when they're hiring candidates. And so, you know, that's our duty to do that. But, duty, I think that I'm trying to think of what the definite, like, there's an actual little tagline. I think it's like doing what's right, regardless of outcomes or something. No, I'll Google it, but
perfect.
I know there was something that came along with it.
They'll put you on the spot. So you're a part of Midwest Cybersecurity it's really, you know, it's cybersecurity, and I don't want to speak for you on exactly what you do, but it's more of a placement, getting people involved with cybersecurity, people that may not have that background. There's a fair amount of training, and then job placement is my understanding, and make sure you clean that up for me. But what exactly does Midwest Cybersecurity do in St. Louis?
Yeah. So, by the way, back up. So duty is fulfilling your obligations is the definition.
Perfect.
And I like that. That's a very poignant point, right? Like we all have obligations in life, whether it's show up to a family member's birthday party. Like those are things that, you know, we don't always want to do the right thing, and we don't want to do those things, but it still is inherently our duty to do that kind of stuff. So I just want to make sure I didn't belabor that, but I'll glance over that. So for the Midwest Cyber Center, we are, you know, we're coming up. Interesting enough, I think we're looking at maybe simplifying that name aspect to make it a little easier to roll off the tongue. We've got a couple ideas we're working on right now. So there's more to come in the next couple weeks to a month. So at the Midwest Cyber Center, you know, we do two things, and I think we do them pretty well. It's focus on, you know, educating this generation of cyber professionals, and we do that through a Department of Labor apprenticeship program that finds non-traditional candidates a pathway into cybersecurity careers. And then we also do that through inspiring the next generation of cyber leaders. And so, you know, how do we the statistics that are out there are 1.5 million jobs are open, you know, are forecasted to be open between now and 2021 in this space. And it's continuing to grow, right? So if it's important or imperative that we get middle school and high school students involved in this, and they see that, you know, cybersecurity is a career pathway that they can pursue. There are, you know, opportunities to go to college, and, you know, whether it's a 2-year or 4-year college, to go and pursue that. And there's lots of individuals in the world that college isn't a great fit. So there's programs like ours that they can pursue. So we engage middle school and high school kids in camps, clubs, and competitions. So we'll have 3 summer camps this year here locally. We'll be rolling out this idea of hacker clubs, you know, to get kids engaged a full school year of whether it's in school or after school, and they're learning some basics of networking and routers and switches and, you know, different operating systems. So the apprenticeship program's been huge, right? We're early adopters, right? So and the word disrupt kind of comes to my mind. We're a little, this idea of apprenticeship is an 80-year-old concept, but in the world of technology, it's still fairly new, right? Like 98% of the people I talk to, when they hear the word apprenticeship, they think of carpenters and electricians and, you know, very trade-centric stuff. And then you say, well, no, you could do this in, you know, dental hygienist or x-ray tech, and, you know, with us through cybersecurity. So, you know, it shortens the timeline in which they complete their apprenticeship. It still couples, you know, mentorship and education and employment, and they get paid while they do this. So it's been a really good mix. We've hit a stride. Employers are starting to understand and recognize that there is a need to think of how they're hiring a little bit differently, right? That we've been trained for so many years that, you know, in order to get a job that makes this, you've got to have a degree. In order, you know, you got to go to college and have a degree. And that's not always the case, especially in technical roles, right? If I know how to code is code. If I know how to code, I can be a developer and don't have to have a degree as long as my code is good. And the same thing can be said for cybersecurity. There are lots of skills, you know, how do I scan a network or how do I run Splunk, CrowdStrike, or run these tools that are, you know, analyzing our networks to make sure our data is safe. So like there are skills you could teach that don't require a degree, but we're playing some catch up on, you know, human resource policies and just the, I don't want to say the good old boy system, but, you know, really the good old boy system that's come along over the years, that's kind of got that ingrained into our mindset that we have to, you know, always hire folks that have that background.
So how do you have that background? How does a drill sergeant end up in the cybersecurity world? And now, I don't know if that's something that you could roll into a place and perform those functions and responsibilities, or if it's something that you know what people need to do to get there. So I don't know what kind of on that spectrum you are, but how did you get involved? How did you get involved in it?
So I can definitely talk a really good game, right? You know, I could go at this point and you know, sit in front of a room of 200 and talk fairly intelligently about the subject and best practices and policies and procedures, but if you put me behind a keyboard, it's all going to fall apart real quick. So I don't pretend to be a technical expert. You know, I know enough about the cybersecurity space to probably get myself in trouble, but, you know, getting here, you know, and then for those that are listening, it's really been around, you know, opportunities and networking and just meeting people that I think have a profound impact in your life. So my board president and I met through a friend, you know, 3 years ago, and had a conversation around something completely different, around bringing a startup incubator focused on veteran entrepreneurship here to the St. Louis market. And, you know, he was launching a government contracting business and didn't necessarily have the bandwidth to do it. That fell through, but we you know, forged a friendship. And, you know, when this opportunity came up, I think I was one of the first people he had reached out to and said, "Hey man, you should apply for this role." You know, so I never thought that I knew I wanted to be an executive director, you know, and that came from my very first nonprofit job. And I think we talked a little bit about that. Just we grew quickly. And a lot of that was driven to some of that very core competencies we talked about in the military, just good mission, vision, values of where we were at. And I knew from a couple roles I've had in the past that I really wanted to be able to be the person to drive that focus, right? Really set the tone, drive some of the vision of where I think we should go and those type of things. And this allowed me to do that. And cybersecurity happened to be a subject. Full disclosure, it scares the bejesus out of me now to think, you know, of all the, you know, there's some safety and oblivion, right? To not recognize all of the dangers that are out there in cybersecurity. So I probably know more now than I would have wanted to know a couple of years ago. But, you know, we do have a national landscape, an international landscape. We have a problem ahead of us around a gap in talent and, you know, filling roles. It's only getting, you know, as we continue to connect more and more stuff to the internet, it gets more and more dangerous and we need more people to do it. So
what is kind of the process of getting somebody from, you know, the very start of your nonprofit and being involved in your project to employment? Like what is that? Do you start with, you know, does it essentially start with these camps that you run in the summer or some of the workshops you run? Is it high school, middle school age kids that you bring through the process and then get them into some colleges? Or is it a, you know, somebody that gets a, you know, a CS degree from Mizzou that now you come and mentor a little bit and then get them out there? Like what's kind of the process of taking somebody through your program?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first step for us is we have info sessions, and those are geared. We have our own. We actually had one yesterday, and that is kind of free and open to the public. And it's really just meant to bring people in, describe the program, explain how it works, and then go from that. And then from that component, we do an assessment. We do interviews. So through the assessment, the interviews, we then can determine. We've got different levels within our apprenticeship, so we can start somebody at a very early stage with a pre-apprenticeship that is going to need some additional support and training prior to putting into an employer, or for that person that you mentioned that has a background or degree, we could put them into a level two and speed up their process for placement. It has helped them find, you know, that role. So we've designed the program to be non-discriminatory, open to anybody, and meet them where they start their journey. So if they're flipping burgers at Burger King, come on out. If they've happened to have a blemish on their record, doesn't matter to me. It may matter to the employer, but doesn't matter to us when we try to place them. So it really is meant to be, you know, open for everybody. We focus our recruitment on women. That represents 11% of the current cybersecurity workforce. We focus our recruitment on people of color. They represent only 13% of the cybersecurity workforce, and veterans. And that's really, there's a large amount of government roles between Scattered Force Base and National Geospatial Intelligence Agency here in St. Louis. So we can take those veterans that are transitioning out that have active clearances and put them into those government roles. And there's a high veteran culture within the security space in general. So they seem to be attractive. I think some of the things that you've asked me about my military career, I think that's attractive in a security space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The apprenticeship, the training that goes along with that, is that something you all facilitate? Or if I came and went to one of your workshops and went through the whole process and the vetting and the interviews and all that and didn't have any background in cybersecurity, do you place me somewhere to get that training at a company where I'm an understudy to somebody and being trained? Or is that something where now that I'm accepted and I've gone through the process with you, I spend the next 6 to 8 months in deep training, right, as part of your group, and then I go work for a company? How's that work?
Yeah, so if somebody came to us and had zero experience, they would likely go into our pre-apprenticeship. That is okay. An 8-week in-person class that we host. We have instructors who are pretty phenomenal. It's a total of 72 hours, and it covers a wide range of things. So soft skills, LinkedIn, resume, interview, those type of things to ready them for placement. It covers IT fundamentals. So it's really the foundational concept of information technology. What is a router? What is a switch? How do those things work? What is a NAT? And then a heavy dose of the NIST cybersecurity framework, which is in the simplest way that I can think to put it. And most folks are familiar with PCI and banking and HIPAA regulations and healthcare. The NIST framework is the first kind of broad standardization of like cybersecurity language that the government has put out. So you know, they conduct an audit, and then they're doing a practical exercises or capstone and delivering their findings within that simulated environment. Once they complete that pre-apprenticeship program and they do a graduation and do their presentation, then they are eligible for placement. So we go out and we find employers, ask them to interview. Once they're selected and they set a start date and they get hired on an employer, they work there for 2,000 hours, and then we turn on an additional 580 hours of coursework that they complete during that time. So that is broken down into four tracks. It is a network engineer, a security engineer, penetration tester, and a security operations center analyst, a SOC analyst. We can sequence those four blocks in any way that the employer would like. So if they're bringing in somebody to do specifically pen testing, we would front load that curriculum so they'd get that quick. Wow. And then to your point earlier, they're getting a manager, you know, who is they're working under and helping them get facilitated and assimilated into that market and their environment. And then they get additional supports from us through, you know, good old battle buddy systems and regular meetups. And, you know, we're doing things like partnering with local financial institutions that come out and do financial literacy classes. So as they, you know, if it is somebody who didn't necessarily come from a great background and, wealth and some of that independence, we want to make sure that they're set up for success. So we're doing, you know, a holistic approach to, you know, mind, body, soul for our candidates, really, and share some of that support with the companies so it doesn't solely fall on them.
And I think you'll agree with this. There's got to, and not to speak for you, but there has to be a lot of satisfaction. You know, I'm thinking of being a drill sergeant with an 18-year-old kid that is just rough and raw and doesn't have these values of loyalty, duty, respect, service, honor, integrity, and courage, doesn't have those. And 17 weeks later, 9 weeks later, they roll out, and the pride that you must have as seeing that soldier stand there, that 18-year-old stand there that now embodies those values, and it can now contribute to the service and the group, right? And protect and all that sort of stuff. Like, there's got to be a lot of pride to that. I would really enjoy that. I also look at what you're doing now where you take somebody, and I'm sure it's not always like this, but you use the phrase somebody that's flipping burgers. Somebody that is flipping burgers that doesn't have any real passion, drive, ambition. They don't know what they're going to do with life. And you take them all the way through that process where they're educated and they're being, you know, the education that they're getting and job placement and all this sort of stuff. And now they're sitting at the end of this thing, really like, a life transformation, like total life transformation that they, and I, you have me really thinking about this niche of cybersecurity and how big that niche is. And, you know, it's one thing in the technical and software world to find that niche, find the need, see the need, and then fulfill the need, and then, you know, kick ass at that need, right? There's such a need for cybersecurity as we move forward. And you've alluded to that, but you're taking these people that were, you know, quote unquote, flipping burgers or struggling with whatever it is to a huge need. And that's got to make you, like, both those scenarios really have to make you feel good and what you're doing for people and the value that you're kind of giving them. That would juice me up.
I didn't think about the parallel of, you know, protecting our country until I just heard you say it, right? There, I guess there is some correlation between training apprentices to military, because we are going to equip them to protect networks and protect company intellectual property and whatever it is they're protecting, you know. And as we look at, you know, threat actors, right, in the space of cybersecurity, where we've got, you know, company threats that, you know, and the Chinas and the Russias of the world have, you know, kids in large warehouses at young ages that are trying to hack us, right, to do nefarious things to our country. I mean, in theory, we are, you know, the battlefield is changing as we go forward. Yeah. Around, you know, whether it's physical shooting and blowing things up or if it's behind a keyboard and protecting networks, there is a parallel there. And I guess it never dawned on me until literally just hearing you say it, that there is some correlation between the two.
Yeah, but I do see that, but I also see, you know, and now you have me thinking about what you do off hours with your children and the coaching you do. You know, you do it because, you know, it's, you know, I'm going to throw words in your mouth here, because you know a lot about it. maybe me talking about why I coach my kids, like, hey, I think I know a fair amount about this game. I'm going to push and drive my children to a certain level that I think that they won't get to unless I'm really helping them out. So I see this, like, you pushing young 18-year-olds into soldiers. I see you, because you're an expert at that, development. I see you instilling these values in your own children on the football field and developing them further because you see a need and you know you can get them further than anybody else. And now I see you professionally doing the same thing with people that are flipping burgers, saying, hey, you come with me and I'm going to push you because 12, 24, 36 months from now, you're going to be working at that place and you're going to be making X amount of money and you're going to have this sort of impact. And I'm equipped to train you and to push you and coach you to get that far. So I see these three verticals in your life where you're just crushing it and filling needs and changing people's lives, really changing people's lives in everything you've been a part of, right? That's, I mean, that just is immediately grabbing me on what you've done. And I really admire it.
Yeah, I think of this, you know, and a former boss, you know, who was in the Missouri market was pretty well known, who I still maintain a relationship with, and he's a good guy. He was the person who took a chance on me and gave me an opportunity, and I'll give him full credit to where I am today, right? And a lot of those are coaching and mentoring. And I think the one thing that he always referenced around his own journey is this idea of ripples, right? We all have a trajectory where we want to go and things we want to achieve in life. And I think we have different philosophies. Some are going to go and push others down as they get there to climb to the top. And some are going to, you know, strap on a backpack and bring people with them and do that, you know, and bring others up. And so, you know, I don't know where my journey takes me. I have no idea in the next 5 to 10 years where I'll be. I don't know where that is, but I do know that there is this idea of a ripple effect that as my career progresses, whether it's through my children or through others that work for me or just people I come in contact with, right? Like how do I bring up the community? How do I bring up other folks and put this on this path to trajectory? So we're actually hiring for a new position, a company relationship manager. And I remembered a kid who had interviewed with us. Oh, he's a young man. I won't call him a kid, a young man now. 7 years ago, he was 22, 23 at the time. He's 30 now. And that kid stuck out to me, you know, 7 years ago. And so when this job came up, I reached out to him. I said, hey, man, I'd love to bring you on. Mm-hmm. You know, and he kind of gave me a little of some backstory on where he was currently at. And he loved his job. He's in the nonprofit space still. So, you know, like most nonprofit professionals, we're probably underpaid for the work we're doing and, managing multiple people. He's kind of on this path of where he wants to go and, you know, be a nonprofit leader and run a nonprofit. And so, you know, one, I offered, regardless if he took the job with me or didn't take the job with me, I was like, hey, I want to keep a relationship and help you be better. Right. So, you know, we'll start some mentoring there on our end. And then two, it really provoked this thought around like, how do we, I'm not going to put I, cause I got a couple of friends that had this share the same interest is how do we improve the social sector as a whole, right? How do we find young people like this young man, who have a passion that burns in their belly to help and serve others? And how do we facilitate that so that the social sector in 5, 10, 20 years has an abundance of good leadership that's driving this change, right? There's some alarming statistic in the St. Louis market of the thousands upon thousands of nonprofits that exist. And, you know, and the evolution of that is changing quite a bit. And I would say, you know, most peers in the executive director side are sitting, you know, towards the tail end of their careers, right? And probably looking at retirement closer than they would that. So who's filling those roles, right? I mean, that's so anyways, long story short, just trying to figure out ways that we can create that ripple effect, you know, multiply that with other professionals in that. And it still boils down to, you know, my military days and those 7 core values that sit there and how do you do it? It is weird to think, you know, I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh man, how am I going to be loyal today? Or what's my duty for the day? But it just,
right.
It things etched in my brain for this point that it drives my daily decisions of what I do.
Mm. Well, that's, yeah. And you just have me now thinking more about me and how much I have to think about them. Cause I do, I, I do think about those things. It's not every day where I'm sitting around saying, hey, how can I do X, Y, and Z? But it's maybe one thing a day of service. Or, you know, I think I, in my early morning notes this morning and some podcast listening very early this morning, it's a very simple phrase, but if you want to be happy, make other people happy. And I remember I wrote that down. I ended up posting it somewhere on Instagram because it's very simple, but it is that mindset of service and doing things for other people and trying to make other people happy and all that. You said something earlier, and I know we have to kind of wrap up here in a little bit. And I really liked it's something you were looking to do. And I think it led you to what you're currently doing. But I wrote it down here, and it's, and you said veteran entrepreneurship. And I don't know what that is. I don't know what you were trying to do. I don't know who you were talking to or what shape that took. But when you said it, it kind of struck me a little bit because, again, I really admire the people that serve. I really do. And I know that people come back from service or from combat and wars and definitely aren't how grateful we are as a country doesn't get reflected back onto them. I just my beliefs, right? And I think there's a lot of shortcomings in getting jobs and skills and things like that. So when you said that, I have this mindset of, you know, taking these veterans that have come back from war or service or wherever they are after their time of service for our country and having them become entrepreneurs, right? But I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what you were kind of thinking or what the genesis was of that thought. But what were you trying to do when you kind of threw that around and met some of the people that essentially got you to where you're at now, this veteran entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I mean, there's a group in Chicago that they've got some structure. And there's an organization that sits in T-Rex, right, where I'm at right now, called Veteran Business Resource Center, that they've done a really good job of mentoring and facilitating, you know, that startup idea, right? And I think a hard part for a lot of, I mean, I'll even broaden it to veterans. Like, I have a business idea. I think it's cool. Where do I start, right? Mm-hmm. And so things like business plans and funding and how do I get this up and running and marketing and that organization facilitated a lot of that and provided some support of that through mentors. I will say the state of Missouri has got some interesting legislature that's going up that is helping promote veteran entrepreneurship. I believe, if memory serves me correctly, I believe they're trying to make GI Bill entrepreneurship friendly, so I can actually go and use my GI Bill to start businesses and use some of that support to be able to do that, which is phenomenal, right? So for me, I've got 2 years of GI Bill left. I did most of my college already, and I could go back and do it, but that's $40,000 that I would give back to Uncle Sam if I never use it. And if I could use it to start a business or do other things, like, that would be a great option for me to be able to do. I can't give it to my kids. That was a reinvestment option. So I don't want to give that money back. So I'm excited about that prospect. But, you know, there's a lot of veterans and there's tons of great examples that are out there. There's a friend, you know, Tim Smith, the local guy, he started a company called Patriot Commercial Cleaning here in St. Louis. And it's not fancy, it's not glorious, right? He cleans commercial buildings, right? Mm-hmm. And so but what he does do that I think is unique to others is he hires only veterans and veteran spouses. He does provide wraparound services, so if he finds a veteran who's down on their luck, he helps that person navigate their VA benefits and goes above and beyond for all of his team. So he went from, you know, cleaning one and two buildings, now I ran into him last week, you know, 50 or so veterans he's employing, you know, cleaning, and, you know, and has had a lot of opportunities over the years to probably franchise, and, you know, he's got a great brand and
that's great.
A good opportunity. But I think he wants to keep it simple, right? And just take care of people and his family. He's got, you know, some young sons that are part of it, and his wife that does his books and keeps up to him. But, you know, there were a lot of people that supported that business plan, execution, delivery. Mm-hmm. There was another guy with Vessels for Veterans, I think his name. He actually donated Tim's first van to him to be able to start doing cleaning and got his, you know, his first buffer and cleaning supplies. So, you know, just some support like that and to learn about those resources is huge. So supporting veterans in that way for entrepreneurship is a positive. Hmm.
That's a great story, actually. So, and I appreciate everything you do. I'm going to say this. I'm going to throw this out there. So I've been doing this podcast since April, and I've had some amazing guests on. that have brought a lot to me and to us, hopefully, those that are listening. It really has been a great year of conversation. I don't know if I've interviewed or talked with anybody that lives and breathes, and I don't know you, Tony. You know, it's a conversation. I don't know you, and we've met and had coffee before. But these seven core values, man, I really feel like you're living and breathing those, and those are just your DNA. So the idea that, hey, I don't wake up thinking about, you know, honor, integrity, or personal courage. It's just who I am. It's what I do. It's been embedded in me. And it's one of those things. I started the podcast selfishly to try to be accountable, to continue to learn every day and be immersed in things that uplifted me and educated me and gave me purpose. You know, I would like to be somebody just like you in terms of those things, having something that I just know I believe in and I can just live it every day. And I don't think about it because it's who I am. Right. I think that's
making me blush, man. I appreciate that.
I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody in quite a while where it's just like, man, he's all that. He's all that, and he lives it and breathes it. And that mindset of, you know, I can do that too. I can be like that too, you know. And I think it's that thing where it's just every day putting those values in front of you, in front of a team, in front of a company or organization, or how you treat your clients, and having it just be like, yeah, I know we talked about loyalty. We talked about it. We talk about it every day, and where it kind of becomes a joke amongst the team. Right. Yeah. We talk about duty every day. Like, we're sick of it. Right. But 5 years later, it's just like, yeah, that's who we are. Right. It's overkill for a while, but now it's everything that we do. And I think that's me personally, trying to be a better person, better father, better friend, better employee, all that sort of stuff. Hey, I asked this of you. Go ahead.
I think the flip of that, right? Right. I'm a good boss. I mean, I'm tooting my horn, toot around the boss thing, but I'm not a boss for everybody. Right. And so those core values are can bite you in the butt a little bit around the idea of duty. And I think, for folks that come and work with me and on my team, you know, we're a small organization. We've got four and a half people on our team. It's show up, do your job. I'm not going to tell you how to do your job. I just want you to own it and do it well, right? Execute. And that's hard sometimes for a lot of folks to jump in and to run with the system or run with the process. And, you know, there's always that kind of question in the back of their mind, like, is this real? Like, do they really want me to, like, do this on my own? And the answer is yes. Like, there's not a right or wrong way to do it. The end result is take the hill. I don't care if you go left and zigzag 18 times to get to the top of the hill or if you do a straight line. So that some of those core values are great in theory, but sometimes there are some of those flips where, you know, it does take some time to go into that. And then one last kind of thought that came in, there's a lot of podcasts and books around this idea of authenticity, right? And I think through being authentic and I think through those type of things. And I generally try to live an authentic human-centered life every single day by lifting up others and being true to myself. And so it generally means I sprinkle in a lot more curse words than I probably should in a sentence and in inappropriate situations. But it's served me fairly well. I find that I get the older I get, the more opinionated I get about things that probably aren't as important. But that's me. Mm-hmm. I want my kids to have the same philosophy and be authentic and true themselves. And I'm fortunate now, knock on wood, that I've got some young teenagers that are doing that and are confident they are, and I don't feel are overly swayed by peer pressure, which is hard, as we all know, in high school. Yeah. So, you know, to continue to do that stuff, and, you know, hopefully those core values do trickle down to my own kids and to others to come around. So, but I do appreciate the kind words, man. It makes me blush.
No, I mean, it's inspiring to me. If somebody has these core values or any core values, what I hear you saying, or what you have me thinking about, is you expect to have those values reciprocated back to you. If I'm going to be loyal to you, you better be loyal to me. If I'm going to have this duty of fulfilling obligations, you better do the same thing, and respect and our ability to serve and honor. Like, these things that are instilled in me as your boss or leader or coach, you better reciprocate those things back to me.
Yeah, loyalty is important to me, right?
Right.
You know, I over the course of 10 years and fundraising and meeting people, you know, I've made a lot of friends in low places and high places, and have done a lot of referrals for business of things that have no relevance, right? Right? Whether it's printing signs, you know, where people are making money off of things and referrals, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. Say thank you, right? Like, that's a very simple thing that if you made some money off of somebody I referred to you, say thanks, right? Like, and that's a core of loyalty. If somebody does something for me, I'm going to be appreciative and say thank you and buy a gift or buy lunch or do some, you know, reciprocate the thank you. There's a generally a quid pro quo in 99% of things that you can do. And it's just doing the right thing. And I think of my core friends. I've got, you know, four good buddies I've been friends with in high school, and we go out and we'll drink and grab dinner or whatever. And there's never a question of who. We're not splitting bills. We're not, you know, you did this and trying to nickel and dime each other to it. Somebody picks up the tab, and we just know that inherently somebody's going to pick up the next tab and it's not your turn. Right. Like, mm-hmm. Those simple philosophies around loyalty is crazy. You know, it's a bit of a tangent and stretch there, but your point, you know, the idea of, and not everybody, and ultimately not everybody lives those same core values. I mean, let's be honest, like that's not everybody is going to be loyal. I'm loyal to a T for sure. You know, the one that I think that as we were sitting thinking that I probably struggle with the most is probably the personal courage thing. And I think generally people struggle with personal courage, and it's not, you know, getting up and doing something, but if it's walking into a networking event, introducing yourself to somebody, that's a small example of it. Yep. But or is it making it, as I'm sitting here listening to your podcast and I'm thinking about my day and thinking about my business, there might be a decision I have to make that's going to require some level of personal courage, right? That I have to decide. And, you know, is it, you know, thinking of the consequences and you're going to analyze it and do this, do that, you know, make an educated decision, collect the facts and be courageous in it. We've had a couple here for us at the Midwest Cyber Center the last couple of weeks that are pushing me out of my comfort zone from a revenue expense standpoint, but in my heart of hearts, I know they're the right decision and it'll all come together. So I just have to work a little harder to get those things to happen.
Yeah. I heard this definition of courage and I really like it. And I don't know where I heard it. It was a meme on the internet somewhere, I believe, but it was, courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is having the fear and going anyway. Right. And I really kind of thought that was, you know, a good definition of courage. And when you said that, it was the first thing I thought of. It is, you know, getting out of your comfort zone for business or, you know, financial things or going to a networking event or like, man, a networking event is not my thing. And I'm scared of it. I'm feared, not me personally, but I mean, like people are, they're fear, like public speaking, but you know what? I'm going to go anyway. You know, that's courage right now. It's different in the Army where there's, you know, go take the hill, as you said earlier, right? There's fear to that. And it's not the absence of fear. Like, I think those 18, 22 year old kids are scared. And I just think they've got this personal courage so jacked into them that they're saying, we're going to take the hill. And yes, I'm scared, but I'm going anyway. And I liked that definition of that I heard a few weeks
ago. I mean, put me in a room of 500 people, right? And I'll talk all day. You know, that the public speaking thing does not bother me whatsoever. And I've just come up under the philosophy, and I try to instill in others, as long as you say blah, 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 blah for an hour with confidence, people are going to listen. And it's a shtick, right? Like, it's as long as you have some level of confidence, you've got your stuff together and look as a total package, like there's some level of that expert knowledge that comes back to it. But from a networking standpoint, when I think that I'm going to go to this thing and have to go out and put myself out there and say, hi, my name is Tony Bryan. I'm, you know, the executive director of the Midwest Cyber Center. Like that gets me for whatever reason, because it is, there's a moment of vulnerability and of that. And that's something that I still to this day, you know, 10 years, 11 years of fundraising and nonprofit and sales type of roles, it's still hard for me. And I got to put on my big boy panties and pull my pants up and tighten my belt and really, like, you know, slap myself a few times and go at it. But it's necessary. And usually if you do it, you're going to find one or two people that you really connect with and want to do some cool stuff, you know? So I encourage people that are listening to go do that. Push yourself out of that comfort zone. If you've got something you want to, you're sitting there and thinking, man, I wish I could do this, or I've always wanted to do that, or I think that would be a great opportunity. Stop waiting and just do it. Right? That's a mantra that I at least try and instill my kids. If you have a goal, pursue it and find things to do it. And if along the way somebody's doing the things that you want to do, right? Like if it's, I'm sitting here and I want to be a project manager and I'm doing X, find a project manager and go, I've never had somebody who I've asked to say, hey, can I take you to a cup of coffee? Just how you and I met, right? And then we met about the podcast. I have an interest in generating content and finding and speaking with people about things I'm passionate about. So that's where our conversation started.
Yep.
And nobody's generally, people are busy, but they're not going to say no and at least give you a little bit of coffee, build a relationship through emails where you can bounce ideas off each other. So, pursue what you're looking for and have that personal courage to go out and do it.
Right. Yeah. There's actually a lot that you just said there that we could get into. Because I think about the conversations I'm having with teams and with businesses and my own children. And you said some really, people need to listen to these, both part one and part two of our conversation, but definitely the last, five or so minutes. Cause I think there's a lot in there, about, getting out of your comfort. Here's my thing. Get out of your comfort zone. My thing is this. I want to be inspired every day. And another guest I had on my podcast, my word of the year is action. I've got, and I write it down almost every day in my planner at the top of it where I could sit there and just remind myself, like today, take action on some things and just don't be somebody that is just inspired, right? I'm like, you've really inspired me on these, like most centrally about this, your core values, right? That's really inspired me today and about what you're doing and your service and all that. But I've got to take action if I'm going to change the things I'm doing or change my community and the people I'm, my clients, my company, whatever it might be, right? But I've got to be able to take that action to it. But your point being of somebody's doing it. Somebody's going to do it. Somebody's going to be there's a company that is going to be the best IT shop or best software consulting company in St. Louis and have these, type A type clients, right? Somebody is. And so, without saying it, you essentially told me, why not you, George? Why not you? Well, like get out of your comfort zone, take courage, go and spite, there's going to be fear, go anyway, right? And have those conversations and put your big boy pants on and go for it, right? Be inspired, take action. I appreciate that.
The easiest person to ignore is yourself, right? And I've done that over the years where I've put that idea of service to others, over my own needs, whether it's coaching, kids, work, mentoring, and that's easy to lose out of your own personal goals and some of that stuff. And I've done that. And so I over the last 12 months where football's winding down, I kind of took a step back and I talked to my wife, like, man, I really want to think of what things get me up in the morning and want to, get excited about doing that kind of stuff and pursuing that. So, all that being said, life's busy. You've got kids, you're working full time, you come home, you make dinner, you're running Joe and Sally to Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts and sports, and your life gets consumed. And then by the time it's done, it's 9 o'clock and you're, watching something on Netflix to decompress, to your point, carve out. And I don't like to get up early if I don't have to, but, build that routine to find that moment of inspiration each day. Or I'm not an avid reader. Find a podcast, find something, just, get those juices flowing and finding those things that can push you and something will click, and then you'll find that thing that you really want to pursue. So for me, I don't know yet. We'll see where it's at. I'm not sure where we're at just yet, but we'll see where the future takes us.
Now, I asked you this last time, what's your LinkedIn bio say in 5 years?
And I don't know. So my wife and I are in this weird kind of life crossroads where our kids are, we'll have three in high school and one out of the house next year. So we're only 4 or 5 years removed from, in theory, being open nesters, right? And so we're, this is an interesting winter where, there's snow constantly and we think of all this cold weather. And I think we're both growing tired of the cold weather. And this is a long roundabout way to give her 5 years. But, I think I don't have any plans to retire or 65 or 70. I want to be able to have a job that still allows me to be at 70 to still have an impact on others and coaching and mentoring. So, you know, I feel like I can do that in the nonprofit space, whether it's as a consultant or board service or volunteering. So, you know, I'll find that. But in 5 years, you know, I hope from a Midwest Cyber Center perspective is that we're, you know, nationally recognized nonprofit that's, you know, changing the way large companies are hiring cybersecurity talent, and that we are, you know, I think we are now, but I think we are the best pathway for non-traditional talent into the space and being disruptive in this world of cybersecurity and, you know, making a dent in the 1.5 million jobs that are out there. So, you know, that would be my goal for the Cyber Center over the next, you know, 5 years on a personal level. If I do my job well right here as, you know, executive director, I've worked myself out of a job where we're so cool, I need to bring somebody in who's way smarter than me to run this thing. And I'm mindful of that. And I look at, you know, there's so many examples of nonprofits that have had the same leader for 25 years. And it's hard to have fresh ideas 25 years later. You get in a rut and a comfort zone. I don't want to be that person that, you know, I wasn't a founder per se. I was a first hire. So a lot of things we're doing has come from myself and my program director's brain. But I want to get it to a point where somebody takes that and then we figure out that next step, right for there. So not a great answer for 5 years. No. As I said, I've ignored myself a little bit over the last several years through other things and I'm really doing some soul searching and figuring out where that is for me personally right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. Again, I want to honor your time. We did this in two parts for those that are listening. So there may be a disruption around the 30-minute mark as we kind of changed and pivoted. But this is exactly how we met. Tony definitely got out of his comfort zone, I'm guessing, given what he said. But it was a LinkedIn. He sent me a message. He said, hey, I'm interested in podcasting and your podcast. Can we get together and have coffee and discuss it? And so we met at a bread company here in St. Louis and talked for an hour or so and scheduled some other time to record an episode. So, that's just, you know, one, it's just connecting with people and just getting out of your comfort zone and just saying, hey, there's people out there that have similar interests, passions, and I want to connect with those people and learn as much as I can. So I'm very happy that you reached out to me, Tony. Very happy because you are
I'm glad we connected. Yeah. You're going to get me motivated to get a podcast going, man. We're going to talk, there's a couple of good bloggers that exist out in the nonprofit space that have some really good perspective. I struggle with the word nonprofit. We're the only industry in the world that describes what we do by saying what we aren't, right? Mm-hmm. Right? We're nonprofit. Like it's like the word alone makes me cringe a little bit. So how do we change that to social sector, social entrepreneurship? There's so many great words, and I'm gonna rally some troops of good friends that have similar philosophies and, you know, hopefully have some mindset changes for the way the space is. And there's so many great examples of that piece. So, you know, stay tuned. We'll find out when I get my podcast. Now that I have a little bit to do it.
When you get it up, we'll make sure we plug it. People have started, people that have been guests on here, we have continued to pump their books that they've released or podcasts that they have started or TEDx interviews that are on YouTube, whatever it is. So we continue to kind of pump those up as people crush things that have been on our podcast here. So listen, to honor your time, I really appreciate Tony making time twice, I think, for us. We had to go through some scheduling. And you can reach Tony with all the show notes. LinkedIn is another good place, and Twitter. How else? I guess just so you say it, it will be in the show notes, but how can people track you down?
Yeah, so LinkedIn, I think it's anthony.bryan1, maybe, I think, is the LinkedIn profile. Is a great way to hit. I generally connect unless you have a picture. That's a crazy rule of thumb, and don't be that one or two person. So connect me on LinkedIn. Love to connect. Twitter, I think I'm lead_the_way is my Twitter handle. Not super active in it. Generally lurk and stalk people on Twitter, especially for shows and events. It's a great tool for that, for real time stuff. But we'll have some more content for the Cyber Center. We've got a great Facebook page and put out some really good content, not just about us, but I think in general about best practices and things for people, you know, just a broad audience to jump in and better protect themselves as a whole. So
perfect. Well, I will have all that in the show notes as well, so you'll be able to track Tony down. I would reach out to him and just connect with him, ask any questions you might have. And I've really enjoyed these two parts. I am ending my episodes like this now because Tony, without question, has got me thinking more about it today. I'm thinking more about it every day. And it's simply just get out of your cube. Just get out of your cubicle, get inspired, take action, get out of your comfort zone. That we are playing in the middle. Most of us, if not all of us, are in the middle. And that's the hardest place to get out of. And I just encourage us to be inspired and take action, get out of the middle, and get out of your cubicle. So get out of your cube. So with that, Tony, thanks. Thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it. And we will talk soon. All right. Thanks, everybody.